guys, it's getting to be the good part of the sports season.
Exciting time to be a sports podcaster, but not necessarily alive.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, got his Mets hat back on, which I appreciate.
I was properly admonished by Kate last week, so I figured that I would don the familiar headgear as
there
usual.
There are no off-season privileges when it comes to alternate team
no hall
hat
passes.
It's Neil, the Statman Payne. Neil,
hey, Chad. How you doing?
How do you feel about the Statman as opposed to Statman?
I don't really know. I mean, I'm not even sure how I felt about Statman in the first place, so I'm just rolling with whatever you guys say.
I think the Statman's nice. It distinguishes you from all the others. And also, to his right.
Well played.
Nice job.
There's just a pause there, but
I had to reverse you guys on the other side.
It's
I had
hard.
To
in real time.
Right. It's Kate Fagan, the ESPNW columnist, and our very own win probability model. Hello, Kate.
I am myself a walking win probability model.
Well, so it depends on how you interpret model. I was trying to go for the double meaning there.
Double entendre.
Are you the sort of just calculated mathematical amorphous being?
Okay.
Or are you a model?
Yeah.
Who is
into the win probability fashion line?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool.
Don't objectify Kate's ability to turn down distance, time remaining, and yard line and score into a probability of winning.
Hi, Chad.
Kate. All right, on today's show, we will break down all sorts of stuff about the Super Bowl, play calling, win probability models that aren't Kate. Tom Brady, is he just blessed by some higher power, or is he really that good? Bill Belichick will probably be mentioned as well. Maybe we'll talk about the Falcons a little bit, too. Then, second segment, just
over
to say
under
goodbye.
On when our next football segment will
I
be.
I mean, hopefully it's September.
Over under. Really?
Over, okay,
I would
so over
say,
under. What other things
I would
happen?
Say four shows. Would you take the under? I would. I'd take the under.
Oh, I'd take the over.
First of all, we're not going to talk about the draft?
First of all, we have control
over the draft.
Second of all.
You have control over
it. Second of all, college basketball is going to dominate this broadcast. Damn, there's three segments. There's three segments of show, aren't there?
Yeah.
That makes it harder.
Yeah, Chad.
All right. I still take the over. Okay. But we're going to talk about Terrell Owens not making the Hall of Fame. And what does he have to do to get into the Hall of Fame, given his resume? Because this is like a classic narrative over stats decision. I'd argue. You guys can tell me I'm wrong. And then for our significant digit, we're going to talk a little bit about a major trade in the WNBA. Elena Deladon has moved from the Chicago Sky to the Washington Mystics. We'll talk about why and what that means for the league. All right, let's get right to it. So last Sunday, the Super Bowl, the New England Patriots won, beat the Atlanta Falcons in overtime 34-28. It was a game that when I look back on it now, I sort of can't. I forgot a few of the major events that happened on the way to the comeback. I sort of like blacked out because what we were seeing was so unbelievable. Like, I kept reading about the strip sack yesterday, and even though 538 was running a live blog that chronicled that strip sack that the Patriots had against Matt Ryan on one of those final drives in the fourth quarter, I don't remember it happening. It's like it entered some time vortex when it was just part of this larger movement of a comeback. Let's start without the numbers. Kate, while you were watching, you know, were you yapping? Were you yelping? Yapping? Yelping? Or yelling? A yap. I can't do it because it'll blow out the mic. I was yapping before the show started.
Okay. Is it a positive? Am I excited if there's a yap?
Yeah, all exclamations that
well,
can be described with the letter
I'm
Y
a professional journalist, and so I don't cheer during games, whether I'm at home or I'm in a press box.
Wow.
So there was no yapping, yelping, or yipping happening in my home. I was silently pleased entering
Wait, are you
the
serious
fourth
right now?
Quarter.
You don't cheer even at home?
Well, I don't know. I mean, after like being in locker rooms for 4 years covering a sport, like, I'm just not invested enough in someone else's outcome to like truly cheer
for your
at
own
home.
Teams you would cheer
if it the only team the Giants
Knicks.
I would cheer the Mets, I would cheer. Yes, but like for okay. Super Bowl without my team.
That's fine.
Okay, cool. Let's clarify that.
Yeah.
If John Starks came out of retirement, you would cheer for whatever team he was on.
Yes, I would yap about him
no matter what
all
team
night long.
He was going on. All right, so you were at home. You were silently cheering.
I was silently pleased that the Atlanta Falcons were winning.
And not just winning, dominating.
Dominating. And the thought crossed my mind, especially when Tom Brady threw the pick six, are we witnessing the end of the Patriots right here? Are we actually watching the last game where it's like their last time in the spotlight? I'm not saying they were just going to be awful next
given
year.
Given Brady's age and given...
Right.
Yeah.
If the Atlanta Falcons win 45-3, which didn't seem ridiculous when it was 28-3... Have we watched the end of the dominance of the Patriots? Like, these are the thoughts that crossed my mind.
And at that point in the game, we should say they were essentially up. They were favored to win by 99%. Midway through the third quarter, they had a 99.6%
win probability. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Win probability. Yeah, and you should know.
I should know. I'm a walking model. Win probability model.
So, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say that you weren't wrong to say you thought you were witnessing something momentous that the game was going to go a certain way.
And then when they showed that shot of Tom Brady... And he was like, it was a aerial shot, and he was dejected, and you could see his head was down, and it must have been after the pick six. My girlfriend Catherine actually said, "Is Tom Brady good at situations when he's down?" Because she doesn't watch a ton of football, but she was basically asking me, "Is this game over?" And I had to honestly answer and be like, "He's actually very." I mean, I was like, "It doesn't happen often." But the last thing I would think right now is that the Patriots are out of it. And that's when the second she asked that, as if she thought, they look awful, they're terrible, he's terrible, she doesn't watch football, I was like, oh, this is going to get bad. And it did. And I'm like you in that I kind of started paying attention to other things once it got 28-3. I'm like, oh, we're cooking dinner, kind of paying attention to what's happening in the kitchen. I'm trying to clean up a little. And I'm like, because there's no way. And I missed the strip sack. Like, I wasn't actually in front of the TV. There were certain plays where that I was there, and all of a sudden it got to a place where I was like, I was standing in the kitchen, I'm all over the place, sorry. And the announcer's like, now the Patriots are within two scores. And I was like, how? How did that happen? And that's when I started paying attention again.
Neil.
No analysis there. I'm just giving you the blow-by-blow of my life.
Ask for impressions.
That's what you got to do.
We got a little live journal.
In the face of that kind of game, that's all you can really
do. That's all you can do.
So, Neil, you and I were live blogging for 538.
We were.
Sort of, you know, frenzy trying to make sense of these events that were happening. We should know. So Neil, let me ask you actually about this win probability thing, and then we can get into the game and what happened. But the Falcons were favored on ESPN's win probability model to win 99.6% of the time, with all things being equal. They, of course, went on to lose. And there seemed to be a lot of yawping into the void on Twitter and elsewhere. Yelling is usually what people do into the void, I suppose. On Twitter and elsewhere about... win probability models are broken. That, you know, if a team comes back to win when it's 99.6 likely that they shouldn't, that means something is wrong with the model or we shouldn't be using these numbers in the first place. Obviously, it got conflated with the election. Our boss, Nate Silver, wrote about that. Does that make any sense that we should be treating this high-profile, incorrect forecast from this ESPN model as gospel that these things are flawed?
Well... that's a difficult question to answer, and I think Nate also kind of abstained from answering it in his post about it, just because one of the things that you need in order to judge how right something that makes like a probability estimate is you have to be able to actually kind of say, well, when it says that something had a 0.4% chance of happening, did it end up only happening 0.4% of the time? And I don't actually know. I don't know what the numbers are. I think that I saw something from Tango Tiger or someone like that years ago that football win probability models are actually really well specified for most of the game. In other words, when they say that there's like a 30% chance of a team winning at some point in, say, the second or third quarter or something like that, that team really does win 3 out of every 10 games that they
Tiger.
Were in that situation.
Somebody tell me what Tango Tiger is.
So Tango Tiger is the pseudonym of
Frosted Flakes
of probably the foremost sabermetric guy in the business today. And I don't know if anyone's ever actually met him in person or anything like that, but he's a guy that's like deeply influential. He pretty much invented wins above replacement, things like that. So he's one of those guys.
Real quick, and then I'll pitch it right back to you. On Reddit, which, you know, source can be questioned, someone posted that using the Pro Football Reference win probability numbers, of the teams who achieved at least a 98.4% win probability this season, which there were 49 teams that got to that level in a game, only 87.8% of them went on to win.
Yeah.
The listeners who may have picked up on some of this anti-win probability stuff is that you can quibble with the model that is putting out win probability. That makes total sense. But the idea that you shouldn't be able to forecast what will eventually happen in the game, we all feel it intuitively. Kate, you said you thought the game was over. You went to make dinner, you turned around, you were shocked when it was within two scores. That's your own type of win probability heuristic that you're making in your brain. So the idea that these things are flawed
I decided it wasn't worth my time because the win probability seemed so low.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, if there's something where the model says that a team has a 94% chance of winning and they only win 87% of the time, that model is not right and needs to be kind of reassessed or whatever. But I do think that there is a little bit to the idea of win probability in general is, by definition, based on looking at the whole range of things that have happened in the past in a certain situation and saying, okay, when this particular situation has happened in the past, how often did Team A win versus Team B? And that is kind of the basis of any win probability model that you make. The problem there is that by definition, it is kind of constrained by the past. So you do kind of smooth things out and make assumptions at the tails. But if something that has never happened before is sort of by definition, it's missing from the data set that you are basing your win probability model off of. So you're inherently going to underrate the odds of that happening because you've never seen it before. Now, the difference between that and the election models, for instance, is that there have been thousands upon thousands of football games played and plenty of opportunities for these kind of crazy events to happen. And so it's really unlikely that you're going to run into a situation, one of these like black swan events in which something happens that has never happened before. And it's also so far out on the tail that the model wasn't actually able to account for it. In an election, there really haven't been many things to train your model off of historically. So you have to build in more uncertainty just to take into account the fact that there's a lot that could play out that we haven't seen yet, and we have to account for that, if that makes sense.
When it says, let's say, 99% win probability, I'm trying to make a distinction here between the model telling me that 99% of teams who have ever been in this position go on to win the game. That's what it's telling me, as opposed to 99 out of 100 times in this team.
The good win probability model is taking into account the strength of the team that is playing.
Right.
So it takes into account the strength of the Patriots versus the team like the Patriots versus the strength of a team like the Falcons.
Okay, so it takes that into account because there is a distinction between, let's say, I'm trying to pick another AFC team. The Broncos being down 28-3 and the Patriots. And you're saying the win probability model takes into account that it was the Patriots.
I would guess, though, that the difference there is really slight at that point, that it's most teams aren't going to come back whether they have Tom Brady or
28-12 with 9 minutes left in the fourth quarter.
One more, but this matters because I do want to discuss overtime.
Yeah.
What was the win probability after the Patriots won the coin flip?
So after winning the coin flip, the Patriots actually had about a 60% chance of winning the game.
I don't think any sporting event there should be a 10% jump after the coin flip. To me, that's a flaw.
It may not
have been
a 10% jump. It was probably a 4 percentage point jump because the Patriots were favored to win the game 56 to 44.
Yeah, it would have been going into the coin flip, just knowing that the Patriots had drawn even and gone into overtime, they would have been better than 50% to begin with.
Right. But I see your point, though, that I think the NFL's overtime structure is wrong. It's a segment for another time. Certainly not.
Oh, so within four weeks?
Not within the next
4 weeks. It's not going to be next week.
Okay, so let's talk about the game now that we've gotten a lot of that throat clearing about win probability models out of the way. I do think it's important because if there's anyone who's going to set the record straight about the sort of value and legitimacy of win probability models after a high profile error. Well, error, I don't know if you want to call it an error. After a high-profile miss, maybe is a better way to put it, like this, is 538 hot takedown. So let's talk about that fourth quarter in particular. Let's talk about once we're at 28-12, which is when the Falcons have the ball. They're driving down the field. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of discussion around the Falcons' play calling towards the end of that game, especially in two vectors. One is that they kept saying hike without the clock running down to zero on the play clock, that they had 10 or more seconds left on the play clock often. I think some people have put together some supercuts that show that they could have burned another 50-something seconds off the play clock, and the Patriots tied it up with 56 seconds left to go. Now, all sorts of things change when there's less time, but certainly their time management, they remained aggressive to the point where even in simple things, where they, even if they wanted to keep calling passes, they could have burned extra time off. That, to me, seems like an obvious misguided strategy. Is that fair to say for the two of you?
It seems like it is, but I think, and if you add in then, of course, the second one being running the ball, throwing the
right,
ball.
So that was the other vector, right?
Both of them are, the larger question is, do you want your team to continue to play with the rhythm and style that it is played with, or do you want the offensive coordinator, Kyle Shanahan in this case, to adapt to situation and take his team out of a rhythm that it's used to in order to burn seconds off the clock in terms of the actual play clock being at 10 when they've hiked the ball and running the ball when in situations that they would have throughout the year passed. I think now that they've lost the Super Bowl, it's very easy to say that you want your guy to adapt to the situation. But we've also sat here at other times and talked about, well, you've been playing one way all year long in the whole game, and then at the end, like in basketball terms, where you all of a sudden you're passing the ball around and you don't want to shoot and you're not efficient or playing in the same style, and that can often set you back.
But there's so many more possessions in basketball. Here,
same thing with football, too, though. I mean, like, if
my possession of football is a chance to score, but it's also a chance to manipulate clock because there's no shot clock in the way that there is in basketball. And so you're able to just run the ball and burn, you know, 7 minutes off or something.
What do the numbers say about, like, what Kyle Shanahan's decisions, like, affecting, like, the added value points per, you know, play?
I mean, there's no question that they...
just saying lots of words.
DVOA,
letters.
Is that right?
No, but it's fine.
That's, DVOA
according
is a thing.
According to Tony
the Tiger... added values...
According to Tony the Tiger...
I'm not sure what Tony the Tiger would think on that. He would think that the Patriots were great. Case, I mean, I think there's no doubt that the Falcons sort of bled win probability out, not just out of plays that the Patriots made, but also out of these like self-inflicted coaching decisions in which, like you said, Chad, once you get to the end of the game, it's almost like they were playing the style that they had played all season, which was a style that maximized expected points. We talked about this metric before where it's like efficiency and picking up yardage and things like that, which I think for like 90%+ of a football game are what you should be going for. It's like all that really matters is racking up those expected points. But I think at a certain point, there, like a switch needs to flip and you need to start thinking about racking up win probability added and not expected points added. And that's where some of those decisions like not to run and stopping the clock and taking sacks and like all of these things. And it wasn't just Kyle Shanahan. Matt Ryan, you know, had that sack that knocked them out of field goal range. Also, there was a hold on the next play. So there's a lot of things in which they just sort of like nickeled and dimed away win probability. And even then, we should say that after all of that stuff, they still were like hugely favored to win the game. And I think if you're a coach and kind of tracking win probability on the sideline, and again, you could have your quibbles about how valid win probability is in some cases. But if you were just kind of thinking about your odds of winning the game, you still probably shouldn't have even felt panicked when you were punting the ball back to Tom Brady up eight. Like, most of the time, most offenses in most circumstances, when they're at their own nine and it's third and 10 and they need 8 points to tie a game with however much time was left in the game, don't win the ball game. And in this case, Brady was the quarterback and not the not an average quarterback, and there were a lot of things that kind of unraveled for them. And you know, I don't know if it's productive to ask how much the Falcons lost it versus the Patriots winning it.
Well, I like the point about at some point you're chasing added points, and you've been doing it all year, but then at some point you have to, adding more points is not as valuable as, you're saying, win probability, but also like losing time.
Losing time, right. That's basically the difference, right? Is like when that switch flips, it becomes more about losing time versus and giving up maybe yards and points in exchange for getting that win probability up to 100.
And did you, in your mind, when did the switch, when should have that switch flipped?
Probably
on that second to last drive, right?
You think when it was 28-12?
28-12. But the thing is,
when it was the strip sack,
the Falcons should have won no matter what. And I think you basically,
that's
just
kind
said
of
that, Neil,
what, yeah, what Falcon, I wrote on Monday.
The Patriots won. The Falcons blew it. Both things can coexist. But even if they pass instead of run, and even if they had those two great long completions on I think their final drive, and then choose not to run. Was that the drive where they were sacked
they picked up
lost field goal range,
about 50 yards, I think, to start that drive. And then by doing things that maybe in hindsight, if they had not gone well for them, we would have been criticizing those play calls, you know, passes and things like that. So it worked for them. 16 games of the regular season, two playoff games, and three quarters of the Super Bowl, and then for whatever reason it kind of disappeared. And yeah, I think it's like the important thing to conceptualize this defeat is that it was like the sum total of a bunch of, you know, small losses of win probability by the Falcons in their coaching, some small losses and bigger losses in their plays that they just didn't make. And then mostly just the Patriots making these crazy outsized, impact plays to grab the game and take control.
We haven't even talked about the role that Luck played in this. That Edelman catch obviously is just a, we talk a lot on the show about how very small things going one way or the other totally reshape legacies. This is a game that certainly that applies to. The other thing I want to say, and then I want to move on to Brady and Belichick, is that we often talk about how risk-averse coaches are in the NFL because they don't want to be held accountable for taking the aggressive path, such as going for two or going for it on fourth down instead of kicking or punting or kicking a field goal. In this instance, this is something where being aggressive is not the right play, it seems to me. Like, we talk a lot about how coaches can be more aggressive. This is what Kyle Shanahan and Quinn did for the Falcons, went over the line, given the way that ratio flipped that you were talking about, Neil, which is when you want to use time to for the end game to get to 100% win probability versus want to use points to get there. That's my last little rant. Brady. 5 championships. Belichick, 5 championships. Kate, you roll your eyes while I say it.
Because I think we've reached a place in Brady lore and in talking about Brady where the only way you can say he's not the greatest now is if you just truly don't want him to be. That's a hard place to land because of what you said just now, like the Edelman catch, the mistakes the Falcons make, those have nothing to do with Brady. And Brady certainly makes amazing plays.
The David Tyree catch doesn't have anything to do with Brady either, for what it's worth, right? There are things on both sides that have worked.
And it's hard for me to say, like, oh, the Edelman catch is all luck because do I see the Giants winning the 07 Super Bowl as luck? Of course I don't. But at this point right now, if I were going to try to, here on this podcast or anywhere else at ESPN, it would become almost politically incorrect to suggest that Tom Brady is now not the best quarterback ever. Like, and I don't know if this is just a current infatuation and maybe a year or two from now, everybody can calm down. And I'm not saying we would. And you can discuss it and you could throw out other quarterbacks. But right now in this moment, the question doesn't seem to be, is he the greatest quarterback ever? It seems to be like, is he the greatest NFL player ever? That's what we've seemed to morph to.
So what I find really interesting about his Super Bowl record in particular is that all the games were decided by 6 points or less. And I think none of the wins were decided outside the end of the fourth quarter or something like that. Yeah. They've all been really tight. And I can't wrap my head around whether that means he's particularly good because he never allowed his team to be outside, you know, too far out, even during the two losses against the Giants. Or does it mean he was within a hair breath? He was a hair breath away from losing seven times. Not seven, but, you know, all
right, he could be the Buffalo Bills of quarterbacks.
Right. And
or something.
So that's super hard for me to get my head around because should the Super Bowls play a role in him being the greatest of all time? After what we watched on Sunday, it's hard to say no, right? Because that was a Tom Brady comeback that was engineered. Certainly the defense showed up for the Patriots in the fourth quarter in particular, but that was Brady and some receivers, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, there are Brady numbers and there were pieces that were written about all of the records that were broken on Sunday in general, but the ones that I didn't even know sort of existed, like while we were live blogging, until it came up at the end of the game, I didn't know Brady was the all-time NFL leader in game-winning drives in the playoffs and fourth-quarter comebacks in the playoffs, and he was both of those things before the comeback on Sunday. So I think, like, you know, there's a long-standing debate in sports about whether clutch exists or not. And I think a lot of people would use Brady as one of the prime exhibits of it existing because of the reasons that you said, Chad. And I don't really know how to unpack the role of luck in that. Was it just a series of coin flips that he happened to get, you know, five heads and two tails in his seven Super Bowls? I will say that just the mere fact of being there that many times, I think, is more impressive. Going to seven Super Bowls is, to me, more impressive than winning five Super Bowls because, and also just the number of 10-win seasons or 12-win or 14-win seasons, another one this year that they just rattled off like it was nothing. I don't know. We talked about this last week, I think it was. I don't know how much of that is Belichick and how much of that is Brady, but I do know that I've always said that basically Brady and Manning are in this class by themselves apart from every other quarterback in NFL history. And I don't know who is number one between the two. I suspect for a lot of people it's Brady just by virtue of the Super Bowl records. But I do know that, I mean, Brady from the sixth-round draft pick that nobody really gave much credence to coming out of college, for him to be one of the two clear-cut best quarterbacks of all time, if not number one, is really incredible.
The most cynical part of me, and you're so cynical, Chad, is like, okay, Tom Brady has gotten lucky in Super Bowls, quote unquote, and yes, he's a great player, but what has made the difference between Tom Brady's game-winning drives and other, is it the fact that he plays for one of the greatest coaches of all time, perhaps the greatest coach? Is it the surrounding? But to some extent, we also have to credit, like, Tom Brady, and perhaps if there's any input that you could offer to say about Tom Brady is in, like, he's been super, I feel like Neil's like dying to jump in here and I can't even like finish with it, but like, he's been so focused and perhaps he has found some little coveted nook of sports land that does separate him. Is that too earnest for you, Chad?
I welcome earnestness. Okay. I think
with Brady, and we've talked about this before, I think with regard to clutchness, that if there is any basis to it, it's almost like the resistance to losing your level of play if you feel nervous or in big moments, not so much the kind of like elevating. I don't see any mechanism by which you can kind of elevate your play depending on it being like an important moment. But it certainly seems plausible psychologically that if you are Brady and you consistently play like one of the best quarterbacks of all time, that also if you're kind of like clutch or whatever, you would play like that no matter the importance of the situation, and other people might lose some off of that in a big situation, but if you can kind of stay at that even keel, that makes you actually better relative to other people who are kind of dropping off in that situation.
I'm simply suggesting that I totally acknowledge the role of luck in anyone's success, including my own. But I also don't want to surrender to this idea of like randomness either, because I don't want to think like my success is ever random. And so I don't want to project like randomness onto other people's success as like a cynical aside. I'm not saying you were, Chad. I'm just saying I'm a Giants fan. And so this is really hard to admit, because I want to just be like, Tom Brady's super lucky, everybody. But no, I can't. I can't actually feel that
way. I'm with you on that. All right. Well, that was, I think, one of our longest segments of Hot Takedown history. Tom Brady making history. Even on Hot Takedown.
We promised a super-sized Super Bowl.
That's right.
So
so let's leave it there and move on to our next segment. Casper makes a perfect mattress. Its two high-tech foams provide all the comfort and support that you need to keep your body at the right temperature. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. It ships for free in a box so small you will not believe that a mattress is fit inside it. You can even try your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free. And if you don't like it, the Casper folks will come and pick it up and refund you everything. No questions asked. Go to casper.com/takedown and use code takedown for $50 towards the purchase of your mattress. That's casper.com/takedown. The code, again, is takedown, and get $50 towards the purchase of your mattress. Casper.com, terms and conditions apply. Only three players in NFL history have more than 130 receiving touchdowns. Jerry Rice in the Hall of Fame, 197 receiving touchdowns. Randy Moss, 156 receiving touchdowns. And Terrell Owens, 152. And yet, for the second straight year, Terrell Owens did not make the cut for the Hall of Fame. This is a guy who finished his career eighth in NFL history with 1,078 receptions. Terrell Owens is confused about why he's not in the Hall of Fame, as I think we are as well. But Skip Bayless has some thoughts about why Terrell Owens does not belong in the Hall of Fame, which he aired, as he is wont to do, on Undisputed. Let's take a listen.
Terrell always led the league in drop passes, which he did many times, in blame deflecting, and in finger pointing. And he's doing it again now with the Hall of Fame. And it might continue to damage his chances to get into the Hall of Fame because it's not going to sit well with those voters. And I've talked all this through with Terrell three times on national TV. So this is not hypocritical on my part. It's not 2020 hindsight. I'm not Johnny come lately. I said the day he retired, I'm sorry. The numbers say Hall of Fame, but the behavior that hurt those teams say, no, he doesn't belong. I'm sorry.
The behavior is not in the bylaws. They don't say anything about
it. Well, it should be.
But you can't.
This is the most disruptive player in the history of the National Football League. I don't know anybody.
So, of course, Bayless is referring to Owens, for example, making a scene on the Star in the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. What was the one where...
Philadelphia, when Rosenhaus were doing sit-ups on the lawn. Right. Well, Drew Rosenhaus wasn't, but Owens was.
Yeah. So lots of... I feel like, too, that was really birthed a new era of sort of cable sports news, where you would cover the sort of controversy du jour in a new way because Owens sort of fed the cycle a little bit. So certainly he's a definitional figure, I would argue, in the history of the NFL, both because of his play on the field and what happened off of it. Let's get to what Bayless was getting at, which is that he led the league in drops. Seems to me like that does not take into account how often he was targeted, so that shouldn't necessarily matter. And then also that he led the league in
finger pointing.
His
blame deflection.
His deflection FPAR was just 37.4. Yeah.
His blame deflection ratio was off the charts. Yeah.
Where do they track those? Is it
I think the NFL
is it on Tony the Tiger as
next
well?
Level stats include okay. That now.
So the question on the table is: should off field behavior matter for entrance into the Hall of Fame in any sport? I think we can address.
Well, I think there's off-the-field behavior, like Aaron Hernandez off-the-field behavior.
If you've murdered
there's
someone.
There's off-the-field behavior.
Ray Carruth is not
But there's
not
all
eligible.
These levels of off-the-field yeah, behavior. Absolutely. There's off-the-field behavior, which is bleeds onto the field in terms of steroid use, but that's technically off-the-field because you're not actually looking at a player's statistics in the game. And that, so it's not ridiculous to consider off-the-field behavior in terms of the Hall of Fame, but I think when it comes to T.O. and this discussion, we're bleeding into nebulous territory about how to define what his off-the-field behavior is, because if he were such a terrible teammate, I don't know how he ends up with the kind of statistics he ends up with, because the evidence would suggest that he couldn't be that awful in the locker room, because most guys who are truly awful in the locker room don't last in locker rooms to the extent that T.O. lasted in the NFL at all.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Like, you know, these ideas of like character clauses and things like that, like you said, there's different levels to character problems. And I'm not sure that if you could quantify T.O.'s deleterious effects on his teammates or whatever. I mean, maybe it would be negative. Maybe you could look at that Eagles situation and say, oh, how much more would the Eagles have won if he had not kind of, you know, had problems and clashed with teammates in that moment. But I tend to think that, you know, the effects of those things have to be spread out among so many different people in addition to the one person that tends to get blamed, you know, in addition to his teammates and the coaches and things like that, that it would be a small effect at most. But I don't know. And that's the whole thing, is we're trying to kind of apply this standard to a bunch of different players in a bunch of different ways for a bunch of different things, most of which are rumors or hearsay or, you know, he said, she said type things. And the only thing that we have concrete in front of us is the player's statistical record. And that's why I think that should get more weight, because it's reasonably objective.
Right. And I think that whatever standard we're applying to T.O., perhaps I could buy into it if we applied the same standard to every single Hall of Fame candidate. Like, just because, I'm not saying Jerry Rice is a bad guy, but just because T.O. is more outspoken and has to some degree cultivated the spotlight doesn't mean that he is any better or worse of a guy than other Hall of Famers who perhaps were terrible guys in the locker room but just didn't hold press conferences. They were terrible in different ways than T.O. might be. T.O. might be more distracting, but you can't. It's the same thing with, like, I know this is like a stretch comparison, but when they do sex testing in the Olympics because they think someone looks like a dude, that's only fair if we're sex testing everybody. And when it comes to Terrell Owens, like, unless you are going to go around and talk to every teammate of every Hall of Fame candidate to be like, hey, this guy didn't make many waves in the media, but was he a good guy in the locker room? Then you can't just apply it to Terrell Owens.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever read Jeff Perlman's book, Boys Will Be Boys, I thought of Charles Haley instantly. That guy was a crazy person in a locker room for many different teams, but he happened to also be on really talented teams. He was good and went to a bunch of Super Bowls, and I think that's kind of the difference. Is Terrell Owens, if he had had better teammates or just happened to win more, would be regarded as, you know, he's crazy, but he gets the job done, instead of he's crazy, but he destroys teams.
And also, like, one more thing. When you talk about drop passes, let alone how many times was he targeted, the opposite of that, you could say, is touchdown catches. Drop passes, touchdown catches. Same way as, like, home runs and strikeouts in baseball. Like, are we keeping guys out of the Hall of Fame if they have, like, 700 home runs, even if they strike out a ton of times, too?
Well, yeah. We don't even have dropped passes for – I kind of doubt Skip saying that even about the years in which T.O. played. Certainly we don't have them for when Henry Ellard played, or, you know, anyone from the 70s and before. So, I don't know. It's crazy to me. I think the bigger thing here that isn't necessarily talked about that much is that the Hall of Fame has huge problems figuring out which wide receivers deserve to be in and not, and how to interpret receiving numbers from an era in which passing went from being sort of a thing that you did in between runs but wasn't really that emphasized to being the core of the modern game of football.
The trick here, though, with Owens is that the quarterbacks who were around him weren't always the best. I mean, Jeff Garcia threw to him for a couple seasons. And
had his best years throwing to T.O.
And so in this case, I think you get around that problem a little bit, Neil, of entanglement between the quarterback and the wide receiver for the Hall of Fame to evaluate. You don't necessarily get around the idea of, or the question of sort of how the game has changed and evolved. But to me, the Hall of Fame should be keeping up with how the game changes and evolves. And so it should be of the era that the player played, was this person one of the great people of that era? And there, the relative comparisons are a little neater. The other thing that's factoring into this is, well, Owens has a theory about what's factoring into this, and he told Bayless this to Bayless's face on not this year, but the previous year's rejection from the Hall of Fame class. So let's take a listen to that.
Why do you think you didn't get into the Hall of Fame?
Well, I think number one, I mean, the guy to my right, I think he has a big part in really a lot of negative criticism of me. And I really have attacked my character in a sense. I think for me, the Hall of Fame numbers, I think they speak for themselves. I think the process is flawed. You think about the guys like Skip, a lot of detractors out there, naysayer opponents, and people that really don't know me on a personal level. But again, now we have social media. We have a platform to really speak and really let people in and shed light on really what's the real instead of hearsay and anonymous sources. And so I'm looking forward to today because I manage by the facts. I don't go by a lot of hearsay and things of that nature. And I think that's what a lot of beat writers and journalists, that's what they do.
So I think that's a really interesting point for all of Hall of Fame processes. And the man on the right that Owens was mentioning was Bayless himself. And so, you know, we are in a moment. We saw this in baseball, too, with Tim Raines. And in baseball, one of our former colleagues, Jonah Carey from Grantland, had been campaigning for Tim Raines for years, essentially, openly campaigning that baseball writers of America should be voting for Tim Raines into the Hall of Fame because of this, that, and the other. And there is a moment now where you can both character assassinate and character inflate on top of whatever the stats are. Carey happened to use stats to make his argument. Bayless has used personal attacks to deflate Owens. And I'm wondering from you guys whether you think there's credence to what Owens is saying, that the sort of the optics around him may not have been as bad before the yak sphere, the sort of, you know, how much people are talking about sports all the time has changed the way that people view him.
Well, I understand the comparison to Raines, but Raines and Jonah Carey seem like, hey, now the numbers we know now show Tim Raines in a new light, is how I interpreted it. Whereas with Terrell Owens, there seems to be no new concrete information. That's where I guess I make the distinction, right? Like, perhaps you could say the quote-unquote new information is Skip and some of the journalists now through rumor and hearsay thinking, oh, that guy's a jerk. But there's no, like, actual new statistical revolution saying, actually,
but the
Owens
statistics
was overrated.
Are equally good for both. I guess that's my point, is that the statistics for Owens show that he's one of the greatest. The statistics for Raines shows that he's one of the greatest.
My interpretation, correct me if I'm wrong, was that when Raines was first starting to attempt to get voted into the Hall of Fame, when he wasn't really getting much, a high percentage at all, there weren't the kind of advanced statistics that now show Tim Raines to be more effective than we probably initially thought.
Right, agreed. My point, though, is that the buffet of evidence that we have for each of them now suggests that they are both worthy of the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And someone had to character, quote-unquote, character inflate. I guess statistics,
yes.
Not inflate. That's the wrong verb for it. But someone had to make an argument for us to get there with Raines.
Mm-hmm.
And the media has made an argument for us to move away from that.
I totally see the parallel. I guess with Terrell Owens, just to assess whether or not I think Skip's character assassination is actually impacting T.O., I would actually probably say yes, because having voted previously for NBA All-Star games, NBA MVP, all of that, as much as you don't want it to, you certainly, when you're at the certain vote and there's someone who, like, you feel like has been professional and easy to talk to and you think everything else is even, you're a human. You are going to lean toward the person that you feel like, in this other variable that shouldn't account for whether or not they're an NBA All-Star, you're like, eh, I'm going to give the nod to this guy, because he seemed like he was professional throughout the whole interaction.
And maybe the important thing in that comparison is that there hasn't been sort of a new discovery of stats that say that T.O. is even better, or that that he didn't have that deleterious effect on his teammates. Like, if we could somehow prove after the fact, and if he had an advocate like a Jonah Carey instead of this detractor like Skip Bayless, who could actually show, like, you know, T.O.'s numbers are even better than they appeared in the traditional metrics, that might play a role. I think there's an appetite for that. But in the absence of that, maybe all you do have is this sort of like naysaying of the traditionalists, and maybe it's the fault of football number crunchers like me that we haven't actually come up with better ways to quantify. And I still keep going back to, we just don't know what to do with wide receivers in general, I think, because the numbers, the benchmarks that you used to have to hit to be able to get into the Hall of Fame, that even as recently as a guy like Andre Reed had hit, if you kind of pull out and zoom out and look at the big picture of the context of these things relative to the league environment, you're running into a lot of guys now and in the coming years that are unquestionably qualified for the Hall of Fame, and there's just this huge logjam. What are you going to do with Randy Moss, who you could also say a lot of the character-based things about, and you know that'll probably get bandied about. What do you do with some guys like Reggie Wayne or Isaac Bruce or even Jimmy Smith, people like that, that probably some of them aren't going to make the Hall of Fame because they don't have maybe the reputation of like a game changer or whatever, but if you look at their stats, they actually have some of the best receiving stats of anyone of all time, even after adjusting for era. So it seems like they've backlogged a bunch of receivers that maybe padded their stats at the beginning of the passing explosion, but kind of got this reputation of playing before the passing explosion. And then now that they've gotten full on into guys who played their whole career since the passing took off, there's this tendency to kind of devalue, almost like a Coors Field effect or something like that, where it's like, Todd Helton, he's not a Hall of Famer. How many hits would he have had, you know, at some average ballpark? I think there's some of that playing into these receiving numbers because they don't know how to adjust for the era.
Okay, great. Let's leave it there. I think maybe we'll make the case for Owens leading into the nominations and the voting next year. We'll try and push that if you guys are
we'll be
his Jonah Carey.
Yeah, we'll be hit. Can we get him on the show, too?
T.O. would come on the show.
He would come on after. He loves analytics.
If he found out we were advocating
right.
for him
yeah.
in a heartbeat.
All right, let's leave it there and move on. Before we get going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by 1-800-Flowers. 1-800-Flowers has great deals on elegant and stunning bouquets that are sure to wow whomever you're celebrating on Valentine's Day this year. 1-800-Flowers has a wide selection of beautiful rose bouquets and arrangements, and the best part is they start at just $29.99. These breathtaking roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. Simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. 1-800-Flowers has exclusive offers for Hot Takedown listeners. Today's offer is 18 red roses for only $29.99 or upgrade to 24 red roses for just $10 more. Available only while supplies last. So to get amazing Valentine's deals like 18 red roses for only $29.99 or upgrade to 24 red roses for only $10 more, while supplies last, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code TAKEDOWN. That's 1-800-Flowers.com. Don't forget to click the radio icon and then enter the code TAKEDOWN. Why wait to wow? Order now. Okay, now on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us this week, knocking on the door, ringing the doorbell, it's Kate Fagan. Kate, what do you have for us this week?
I have 26.1.
All 26.1?
26.1. That is the PER of Elena Deledon during last WNBA season. All right, so Elena Deledon just got traded. Huge trade in the WNBA. She got traded from the Chicago Sky to the Washington Mystics. And she forced this trade because she would not have become a free agent for years. It's actually even hard to understand how many years, because she would have been a restricted free agent after next year, but then the Chicago Sky could have franchise tagged her, because this crazy thing exists in the WNBA where they can name you a core player, same thing as an NFL franchise tag, for 4 years.
Whereas NFL's 1 year or something,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And so Elena Deledon is from Delaware. Washington Mystics, the closest team to Delaware. She's really close to her family. So instead of waiting for like however many seasons until she finally could have decided where she herself wanted to be, she was willing to sit out this upcoming season to force the trade from the Chicago Sky. And she did. Sky traded her. And this doesn't happen that often in the WNBA, that like a former MVP at a young age in the prime of her career is able to shift teams.
Yeah, and in fact, it doesn't happen in the NBA very often either. Only 7 players had a PER of 26.1 or better in a season and ended up playing for a different team the next season, and those players were...
Whether it be by trade or free agency?
Yeah, were Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Kevin Durant, Kevin Love, LeBron James twice going from Cleveland to Miami and then back to Cleveland, Moses Malone famously won the MVP and then went to Philly, and then Shaq going from Orlando to LA. So those are the types of players that she is kind of equivalent to, and those were all moves that really drastically reshaped the championship picture of the NBA each time that they happen. So that's to give you a sense of how important this is for the WNBA.
Perhaps like the only place where it doesn't feel like an equivalence is how I feel when a player forces a trade, because often
in the NBA.
Yeah, or in basketball, and it bled over into Elena Deladon, because I'm used to in the NBA, if somebody's like, so-and-so's forcing a trade, it makes me feel like they are hard to deal with, the player. But that's because in the NBA, free agency is often reached more frequently.
And far earlier.
And younger. Yeah. And so you're like, all right, well, if you signed with a team, but you're already forcing a trade, or if you can't wait until your rookie contract's up, it seems like it's almost a referendum on the player. Whereas, but with Elena, it's like she would have had to play in Chicago for like 9 years before she could have become a free agent. So it's a totally different situation when it comes in the WNBA.
Why is that rule there? Because the WNBA feels they have such a fledgling fan base for each franchise that they want to keep the star players there longer?
No, because the WNBA Players Association and their combined agents don't have the strength to fight rules that are heavily in favor of the team at this point. I mean, they just don't have the power to be able to say, oh, we're willing to sit out. I mean, that could be the end of the league forever.
Right.
So they just don't have the collective agency to avoid these types of anti-player rules.
Yeah, making a player wait that long to be a free agent, it significantly depresses her earning potential, just because once you hit 33 years old in this particular case, the teams know you're not going to be able to produce as much, and that your best years are in the rearview window. And so, of course, they're not going to give you what you're worth. So you've played on this kind of pre-prime contract for your entire prime, which didn't pay you what you're worth. And then now you will play on this post-prime contract, which will also not pay you what you were worth if you had been paid what you were worth in your prime. So it's kind of a losing proposition at both ends.
The only upside that WNBA players have in how little they're paid is that they actually can sit out, and it's not an idle threat.
And so, play in a foreign league.
Yeah, and Sylvia Fowles did it because it's like, oh, I played overseas for like $500,000. So if I really want to force a trade and I'm missing out on $80,000 of the WNBA, it's not like I'm missing out on $8 million. I'm truly willing to sit out this season to land in the city I want to land in.
Yeah, it's interesting. They can't take collective action to sit out, but they can't take individual action, which is sort
capitalism
of
capitalism at its finest.
Well,
or the
it
opposite?
Just it undercuts the union even further. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd have to think about that a little more. Okay. That'll do it for this week's show. My computer has died as only once before. I will have to do this by memory. Neil Payne, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Kate Fagan, our walking win probability model. Thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Our producer is Katie Ferguson. Our intern is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Jorge Estrada and Tony Chow. Our podcast core player is Jody Aragon. We are on your favorite podcasting app and on iTunes, of course, as well. iTunes.com/538 will take you to us. Subscribe, tell your friends.
Rate and review the show.
Right.
It helps people discover the show.
Yes.
The program.
Our
theme song.
Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.